I showed Tristan and Frank out, and they went to the basement to drink scotch and speak of deep, dark things. Melisande stayed to help clear dishes. She has seemed a little distant lately, and uncharacteristically wistful. So I asked her directly what was going on, knowing as she does that I've decided to step away from Dodo in all capacities except witch work. She confessed she was thinking of leaving too, entirely, sometime in the new year. She attributed this to A, Blevins's unending denigrations of her competence, and B, more significantly, the growing shift away from diachronic work, where her expertise is clearly valued, and toward psychological operations, which she not only is not expert on, but which she finds more ethically problematic, as do I. I think, however, there is also C. She and Tristan have teetered at the edge of a relationship for so long, and never yet fallen into it, and she is tired of that balancing act. Men are always better at compartmentalizing these things. I don't especially say that in a laudatory way.
Exchange of posts by Dodo staff on Anachron's Odin Channel. Day 1937. 17 November, Year 5. Post from Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons, 0830.
For fuck's sake, where is Magnus? He was supposed to be here on the 0800 bus from the SARF for a seminar in Violence's Ethnology. This is the third time he's been late. Usually he's a morning person.
Reply from officer on duty at SARF, Supervised Anachron Residential Facility, 0841.
He was out the door at 0800 sharp, but apparently did not get on the bus, which was waiting outside. We'll check cameras.
Follow-up from officer on duty at SARF, 0852.
Front door security camera footage is ambiguous. We see him exiting the door and going down the front walk toward the bus, but just as he is exiting the frame, he appears to juke sideways. Magnus has always been fascinated by the security cameras, and so he probably knows where the coverage areas are. Evidence suggests he proceeded down the walk until he believed he was out of frame, then made his move.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 0856.
Alerting DOSECOPS and Dr. Blevins, acting head of CCOD. Anyone who sees him or learns anything, pipe up here so we can cancel the alert.
From Major Sloan, ranking DOSECOPS officer on duty, 0912.
We've activated the protocols for AWOL Anachrons. These have been worked out in advance with local police departments and transit police. Obviously, we want to find the missing Anachron, but we have to treat it as a sensitive matter. We don't want someone like Magnus ending up in the slammer with a random assortment of criminals. Currently checking all bus and T routes in the vicinity of the SARF.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 0920.
Respectfully, Major Sloan, Magnus isn't going to hop on a bus. He can walk faster than most people can run, and he can run faster than cars and buses are capable of moving in Boston traffic. He has been missing now for 80 minutes, and with his level of physical fitness, could be anywhere in a 10 or 12 mile radius of the SARF by this point.
From Major Sloan, 0932.
Acknowledged and understood. Also, putting out feelers to local PDs and social service agencies for reports of weird or threatening behavior.
From Dr. Blevins, 10:05.
Just became aware of Magnus's disappearance. May I suggest sending officers to check local gridirons, sports bars, any place connected with football. I took him to a game last month, and he seemed quite interested.
From Major Sloan, 10:16.
That's a useful lead, Dr. Blevins. Anything else in that vein?
From Dr. Blevins, 10:23.
I also took him to Walmart, which he quite enjoyed, but A, he would have no way of locating a Walmart, and B, even if he did, the closest one is many miles away.
From Officer on Duty at SARF, 10:56. Redacted. Who frequently takes the night shift at the security desk here,
told me the other day that Magnus had borrowed his iPhone and apparently used the map application. Magnus was also seen using a pen to draw on the palm of his hand. From Major Sloan, 1101.
Need to wake up, Redacted, and have him check the search history on his phone. Sounds like Magnus drew a map.
From Dr. Blevins, 1105.
Suit yourself, Major Sloan, but I believe you are grossly overestimating Magnus's mental capacity. He cannot even speak English, much less type search terms into a navigational app.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1200.
He's been gone for 4 hours. Sit rep?
From Major Sloan, 1201.
Just writing one up. Nothing yet. Redacted's phone didn't preserve any search history.
From Major Sloan, 1327.
Bingo. We have a report from the Walmart Supercenter in Lexington that a man matching Magnus's description has been using a computer in the electronics department for a couple of hours. It's only 10 miles. He could have Paul Revered it on foot, sending all available DOSECOPS units.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1330.
Please advise Walmart rent-a-cops not to engage Magnus. I can't even...
From Major Sloan, 1331.
Neither can I. I've already emphasized this to them.
From Major Sloan, 1410.
Plainclothes DOSECOPS personnel made peaceful contact with Magnus and escorted him from the Walmart without incident, interviewing witnesses. Magnus is in the SUV, should be back in Dodo HQ soon. He's calm and relaxed.
From Dr. Blevins, 1415.
Any indications Magnus might have divulged classified information to civilians?
From Major Sloan, 1423.
All eyewitness reports so far agree that he said nothing, which stands to reason since he doesn't speak English. Sounds like he'd brought a Sharpie from the SARF and was using it to draw on his hand and forearm. That's what freaked out the store management and caused them to call it in.
From Major Sloan, 1439.
Magnus is in the building, being escorted to conference room for a debriefing.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1442.
Don't you guys have a lockable room down in DOSECOPS land?
From Dr. Blevins, 1445.
No need to escalate by placing Magnus in something that looks to him like a prison.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1447.
It won't look to him like a prison. He's never seen a prison. It'll look to him like the nicest, cleanest room he's ever seen in his life, until a few weeks ago.
From Major Sloan, 1505.
Still waiting on the Norman interpreter so we can interview him.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1508.
For fuck's sake, I can do that. No need to wait.
From Major Sloan, 1511.
We are observing him in the meantime, as part of a psyche eval. He's scratching himself with a paper clip.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1512.
Huh?
From Major Sloan, 1514.
Just superficial scratches. Not enough to draw blood. Maybe the ink irritated his skin.
From Dr. Blevins, 1523.
Why are the alarms going off?
From Sergeant Jones, 1525.
Major Sloan asked me to notify everyone that we got a report from the Walmart that Magnus has a knife. Apparently they reviewed their security camera footage and saw him taking it from the kitchen section and hiding it in his trousers. He's had it the whole time.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1525.
On my way.
From Captain Gomez, 1526. Need medic, conference room. From Sergeant Jones, 1526.
Facilities in lockdown. All personnel following active shooter protocols.
From Captain Gomez, 1528.
Need medic, stairwell 2.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1528.
He's on ODEC level. He's in ODEC 2 with a Muon. It's Constance Billy. He's gone. Constance shaken but unharmed.
From Dr. Blevins, 1530.
Gone where? To what DTAP?
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1532.
Constance says he threatened her with a knife and demanded to be sent to 912 AD Svelvik. It's a DTAP she knows pretty well.
From Dr. Blevins, 1534.
Isn't that 3 centuries before his time?
From Dr. Melisande Stokes, 1540.
912 Svelvik is like Grand Central Station for old-school Vikings.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1545.
Magnus has always been fascinated by that era. It doesn't surprise me that he would choose to go there. He knows he can't come back, ever, after what he's done. So he picked the one place where he could live out the rest of his days as his fantasy of a classic Viking.
From Dr. Stokes, 1548.
Maybe he'll go discover America, smiley face.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons, 1550.
Not actually that funny, Stokes.
Magnus's search history. Recovered from computer on display in Walmart electronics department. Truck. Boobs. Free boobs pics. Lie, Doe, Kane. Lie, Doe, Kane, Numb. Numb. Lidocaine. Topical anesthetics. Scar. How make scar. Scarification. Black Friday. Black Friday Walmart. Truck box. Metal truck box. Big metal truck box pics. Big truck pictures. Truck with big steel box. Shipping container. Shipping container image. Shipping container Wikipedia. Shipping container door. Shipping container trailer. Tractor trailer. Semi-trailer. 18-wheeler. Naked woman. Naked white woman. Redacted. Fugger. Fuggers where live. Fugger boss. Gun. Best gun. Gun shoot how. Gun how shoot YouTube. Revolver how shoot. Semi-automatic how shoot. Shotgun. Shotgun how load. Bullet armor. Gold. Gold wear. America why rich. America why rich history. Conquistador. Conquistador gold map. El Dorado. Cibola.
Tenochtitlan. Tenochtitlan map. Tenochtitlan harbor. Tenochtitlan closest port.
Veracruz. Veracruz Harbor. Veracruz Map. Veracruz Navigate Europe. Google Maps.
The Lay of Walmart. Translator's note. The Lay of Walmart comprises 2 parts. Handwriting analysis confirms that both were written by the same author, self-identified as Toki Olafsson, a scout originally dwelling in the village of Svejik, modern-day Svelvik, in the Oslo Fjord in the early 10th century. Part 1, written on sheets of birch bark using oak gall ink, was recovered from a peat bog outside of Svejik by a covert dodo archaeological extraction team in the wake of Part 2's discovery. The overall style is typical of Norse epic verse of Toki's era, though somewhat rough-hewn, as many parts seem to have been written in haste. Not all sculpts were literate. Toki was, and seems to have used written documents as an aid to composition and memorization. Of note here is his use of modern English loanwords such as Walmart and Ditap, which is his transliteration of DTAP, Destination Time and Place, a common acronym in the Department of Diachronic Operations. Part 1. A hearing, I ask. A skalt am I. A witch woke me, hurried to my hut, summoned me from sleep, beseeched me to bear witness, record in runes a traveler's tale. Tailing her out of town, I heard tell of what had happened. A man sent from distant time and place. Magnus, mighty one, subject of sagas, treasure-taker, ship-shaker, ring-bearer. Yet when he came, not as well clad as the cats the witch kept. To her home we hastened. Magnus, blanket-bundled on a bench, sat by the sparking fire, staring amused at the flame's antics. "Say nothing," he said, stretching out a hand. "Hear only, heed me. Memorize my words, O skalt story-stretcher, keeper of epics. Write them in runes on the morrow. Sent hither was I just now, naked. A witch-friend, fair Frankish girl, got me away in good order from a far place, a fat land. Walmart is where the thralls of that land store up their wealth. A fat fool took me there, thinking he would make me quail, cock-shriveled, cuckolded, chained by the sight of such treasure. While the memory of that mart remains mine, I'll make it yours too, tale-teller. We'll wend our way to other times, tell the tale, hiring a host of heroes, return as raiders to plunder that place, and carry on Viking thenceforward. Of the fat land I'll say little now. Too many tales to tell of its weird wonders. Walmart is what I have just seen, not so long ago as when you lay sleeping. Greater than any Goth village is the width of its walls, sheer and strong. Thrice gated, though, with glass. Frail fencing for a treasure trove. For in Fatland, visits from Vikings are few and far between. Fear rules, fellows, makes men meek. Glass gates are good enough. That barrier breached, all the land's luxury lies ready for reaping. Here's what my memory holds of how it is sorted. Long lanes, laden with loot. Wide ways, well made for waging war, like the roads of the red-crested Romans, ordered just so, as warp and weft. Too many for merchants to memorize, marked, therefore, with runes they can read. Romans wrote them first. The fat ones stole them, as well as Arabs' numerals, arranged below. For each district of the treasure town, a Roman rune written, raised high, for each lane lying below it, an Arabic number to know it. South faced the glass gates. The fat fool northward led me, shouldering them aside, greeting a guard, vested in blue. Scarcely strength to stand had that old ogre. To our right, ranks of clashing carts waiting to be wheeled and weighed down by fatlanders too frail for fardels. Sightseers only, we spurned these. Till-keepers' tables cluttered our view. Beyond them, still north-questing, kiosks and cairns covered the place, towers of trifles. From there to the west lies all the food in the world. North, a cornucopia of clothing, all colors. Doubling back south, white witches doling out drugs, physicians' filters. Eastward, though, lies victory for Vikings. Counting the cairns, the merchandise mounds standing in the center of the wide east-west way, stop at the sixth. Atop, it's an image. A fair lass, tresses flowing, like the lush Lindalsfallet, where it rushes over rocks, teeth shining like Snæfells Jökull. Cradled in the lass's hands, a bottle, bewitching brew, beautifying the hair. Below it, many more such, stacked like soldiers. That is the landmark that leads you to the left. A long lane, laden with loot, Its rune is like Berkano, the beginning, its number 105. Let it lead you north. Little more to say. For in fewer than 5 paces is what your hand has hungered for since you found yourself in Fatland, alone and naked. Numberless knives, new and needy. Thus the blanket-wearer, who now baited, hefting a horn, wetting his whistle. More mead, if you are willing, witch. There's riches in this tale. Inga Bjorg was the witch's name. South of Sverdvik, alone she abided here in this hut, cozy, kept clean, cats her companions, dogs her defenders. Let none say I don't serve a guest sweetly. Here is your horn, more mead for Magnus. Gladly I'll listen to more of your story, but the riches you rave of mean ruin for me. Here in my hut I am happy, grief bringing gold, land needing labor, swords, slaves, silks, swag. To what end should I, Ingebjorg, buy into this business? For that there's an answer, said Magnus. Grania's grief made her great with rage, drove her to desolate Ditaps, reddened her hands with friends' blood. To you, welcoming witch, I'll have more to say when the sun sheds its light on the shore and cocks crow. Now is night work, telling the tale to Toki, the scout. Drinking deep of the mead, wetting his whistle, Magnus made the most of it then, telling to me, Toki, tales of Walmart, where the weapons were, how to find food. When the sun shed its light on the shore, when the cocks crowed, home I hide, wrote it in runes, left nothing out, then slept soundly. Toki, time to depart, were the next words I heard. Magnus and Ingebjorg stood staring. Distant Ditaps await us. Hardy heroes restless to ramble, we'll sway them to our side. Blanket-bound was he still, blowing on blue hands. Furs, I will fetch you, friend, said I. No need to ride so rude-clad, cold and uncovered. We won't ride, said he. Naked will both of us be, when the witch has her way and we're at the Ditap. Sending it's to be, then, said I. Travel through time, dark and dangerous. Ingebjorg's will isn't what it was when last I heard tell. The witch was fur-clad, fierce-faced, fingering her skein, but half in this world. I have heard tell from the man Magnus of a future that is to be feared. Alchemists and astronomers, addling the wits of witches, stripping us of our strength. Helpless hags they'd make of us. I'll not have it. Put away your pen. In a peat bog, bury the bark. Let it lie there, a legend for our friends in the future to find. The story will stay in your mind, son of Olaf. Tell it true when you get to the Ditap.
Exchange of Posts by Dodo Staff on Diachronic Ops Miscellaneous Odin Channel. Day 1943, Monday before Thanksgiving, Year 5. Post from Dr. Melisande Stokes.
Checking on a deed assignment I just got that confuses me. In 2 days, I'm supposed to go to San Francisco 1850 to recruit an immigrant Chinese witch there. It's listed as a one-day deed, so I'll be home in time for Thanksgiving dinner, supposedly. Chinese is my weakest language. We have 5 doers who are fluent, 3 of them ethnically Chinese. At least one of those, Julie Lee, not only currently available, but also, for what it's worth, a muon. I'm curious why I was assigned this deed. Also, regardless of who goes, I'd like to see the Chronotron data on why we need to recruit this witch so close to July 1851. Whether the goal is to bring her forward to work as a contemporary witch, or to do some final magical adjustments in those last few months, why not go back several years earlier and recruit her directly from China? I'm sure that data has already been crunched by the Chronotron, CCing Dr. Oda and Mortimer for confirmation, but I find this puzzling.
Reply from Mortimer Shore.
Dr. Oda is still on vacation, Reed, getting ready for the Addo move on Friday. I will look into all this ASAP, but I'm a little overwhelmed with work right now. My understanding is that Gordon Healy and Mary Case are our data whisperers there at the moment, and they're both cool. They're not great at communicating in regular English, though. I can ask them to summarize stuff for me, and I'll get back to you about it.
From Dr. Blevins.
Dr. Stokes, I understand you have reservations about your Wednesday assignment, and out of respect for your senior position within Dodo, I am willing to respond to them, although it is against protocol for a doer to question their mission. While I understand that you would like an explanation, you do not require one to do your job. I've told Mortimer Shore that, as he already knows, of course, he needs to focus his time and energies on projects that actually require his attention. So please do not expect him to follow up on his last offer to you regarding Chronotron data. Mel, I do realize it must be unnerving to go to a DTAP that is so close to the very end of magic. As Erisabeth has recalled on innumerable occasions, she was hardly able to perform magic at all for the last year or so before the eclipse. So I have a proposal that I hope will reassure you. When you go to the San Fran DTAP, Grania has offered to go with you. And as soon as you've accomplished your deed, which, if I recall correctly, is to recruit a witch from that era, Grania will send you back here immediately. She will then get back here with the help of the KCW. She's not nearly as unnerved about the timing as you are, and is happy to make the journey if it will help you feel more secure about returning. So, in short, don't worry about it. Just do it. After all, it's your job.
Exchange of posts by Dodo staff on private Odin channel, days 1943 through 1944. Monday and Tuesday before Thanksgiving, Year 5. Post from Dr. Melisande Stokes to Lieutenant Colonel Tristan Lyons and Mortimer Shore.
Any thoughts on this deed? Grania seems awfully cozy with Blevins lately. Also, Mortimer, are you being blocked from Chronotron data? Mel.
Reply from Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
It's fine, Mel. Grania's resourceful. She'll get both of you back here safely. She's hardwired subversive when it comes to authority. I heard the coders classified her chaotic neutral. She's playing Blevins, survival instinct, force of habit. Erzabet genuinely likes her, and Erzabet would not like her if she took the Grania-Blevins thing seriously. Grania's got your back. If you're still gone on Friday, I'll have Erzabet send me back to help you out. Tristan.
From Mortimer Shore.
Hey, Mel. Not being blocked, really am swamped with a sudden wave of mundane coding assignments that came unexpectedly from Blevins. Nobody else except Oda has the security clearance to do it, and he's busy on Addo moving. I agree with Tristan. But heads up, Tristan, you can't go back to help Mel out because you are about to get a whopper new DD. Earliest era witch recruitment we've had yet, 20,000 BC Germany. I only know because Erzabet has been surfing the wiki doing research. She needs some kind of reference point to send you to. I turned her on to the Hohlefels caves in the Ach Valley. Have fun, LOL.
From Lieutenant Colonel Lyons.
I haven't heard anything about that, but I'll start brushing up on my cave art. Wonder how the hell they expect me to recruit a witch who can send me back here.
From Mortimer Shore.
That's why they pay you the big bucks. See you both when you're back from your extreme detaps, LOL. Peace out, Mortimer.
Part 5.
Diachronicle. Day 1945. Day before Thanksgiving, Year 5. In which the road to perdition is paved with gold. Grania and I had arrived in San Francisco, without benefit of the level of research to which I was accustomed. Levins, clearly smitten with Grania, had allowed, one might even say encouraged, her to learn all manner of internet searching, and she assured me that she had done all the background work for this detail. There were no particular skills required, it was argued. As San Francisco in 1850 was such a madcap swill of different cultures, and so extremely underpopulated by women, that even if I wore pants and chewed gum, I would not stand out as a regular. Well, no matter how prepared I was, I would still stand out for being female. Because we were so close to the end of magic, the intention was to get in and out quickly. As arrival was always in the nude, and this was San Francisco at the start of the gold rush, it was sensible to arrive in a brothel. Grania had chosen the Golden Mounds, right on Portsmouth Square, which was so new, having been rebuilt twice in the past year due to monstrous fires, that it still smelled of pine sap and paint, which stale beer and stale sweat had not yet masked. Imagine whatever tawdry image of gold rush whorehouses you like. This one was surprisingly well appointed, despite the slapdash construction. Somebody somewhere had come into massive amounts of gold leaf, and the whole place glittered. You've surely seen the photographs of prostitutes of this era. I need not spend the ink describing them. But I was not prepared for the loud, rowdy, almost assembly line attitude of the place. Curtains, at best, separated nooks for nookie. Sexual Congress. There was nothing close to privacy. It was a madhouse of copulation. This made our arrival. In the corner of a large room with some 8 beds, all sectioned off by hanging tapestries, entirely unnoticed. We both stumbled to our knees. I recovered quickly, for I had been sent many times. Grania was a little slower to shake it off, but then she was more in her element than I, and in a trice, she'd pinched a couple of day dresses. Corsets and blouses generally remained on the girls, at least at this tier of low-latency prostitutional services. "We'll do better to find their non-work clothes," I said, as Grania tossed me the more modest of the two dresses, "since we shall have to go out on the street." "No need to dress primly here at all," she replied cheerily. "Not for the time that's in it. Here's some knickers that look clean enough." And she tossed me some linen bloomers, not unlike the ones I'm wearing now, although these are a much finer weave, and mercifully, much cleaner. I must be grateful for these small blessings now. We made our way downstairs and headed for the main door, when a wasp-waisted figure stepped between us and our egress.
"Who are you?"
demanded this older woman, dressed more as one imagines ladies dressing in the early Victorian era, so clearly the madam of the place. She aimed the query straight at me, and I, unprepared, without the usual backstory we were always careful to produce, hesitated.
"It's Grandmam, surely," said Grania with a winsome smile. "Mary it was sent us over from the other place. There's a ship arrived with lots of new women, and they haven't the bed set up. If you don't want us, we'll be striking out on our own. But we've heard such agreeable things about your terms. Will you take us so? Shall we just be fetching our bags from the harbor side? Pay my cousin no mind. She's deaf and dumb."
The woman frowned.
"Mary should know we don't take Irish," she said. "It's a surfeit of English ladies you've got, is it?"
Grania asked in a playfully disbelieving voice. And then, in an odd accent somewhere between London and Appalachian, she asked,
"What if we were English, then? Will that work for you, Johns? We can easily be English. My cousin here, she can be anything."
Now the woman looked confused, but in a way that suggested Grania would get her way. With a brusque gesture, she motioned toward the door.
"Very well, then. Get your things and come back. We can use the help."
"Help?" Grania quoted with a snigger. And out we went to meet the city. "Who's Mary?" I whispered as we exited. Grania shrugged.
"Mary's such a common name. There will always be at least one nearby. 'Tis the best name to be using when you're counterfeiting."
To say that San Francisco in 1850 was a city being built on gold rush fever does not begin to capture the chaos, havoc, greed,
and rough-hewn glamour that made up the peninsula. It had taken almost no time at all for the sharpest of the 49ers, or Argonauts, as the tens of thousands who came by sea were called, to realize that the real money was to be made not from mining gold, but from selling all manner of goods to the fellows who were trying to mine it. Shops of every conceivable sort had sprung up in buildings around the waterfront and on the route out of town. Freshly built wooden buildings that, I did know this much from some hasty research, had already burned in three enormous conflagrations over the past year or so. I also knew from my abbreviated Googling that a fourth great fire would destroy a swath of the town just a few weeks after our arrival. This, in concert with my awareness that magic was soon to wane entirely, added a certain urgency to our deed. I was eager to accomplish it and get out quickly. Between credit and gold, the town was obviously, and almost dangerously, wealthy. Grand, elegant palace-like hotels and buildings were being constructed in a slapdash manner, even faster than they were burning down. The building we had just exited was three stories tall and brightly painted, facing onto a large city square. I looked to either side. The entire block was a series of theaters, saloons, and inns, bustling in the bright midday sun with prostitutes, gamblers, con men, and the occasional gentleman. Given there was no easy natural source of water or wood, I cannot imagine where all the resources to do this were being obtained. "Amazing," said Grognier heartily, gazing down the hill toward the harbor, in which was moored many hundreds of tall ships. 2 years ago this was a village. Now this. See all them ships? Marooned there by their crews, so they are. The crews having jumped ship to go prospecting. So it's taken possession the city folk have done, and turned them into homes, inns, taverns, brothels, theatres. And I do believe a jail. And look, that's where the Chinamen are living. She pointed to a peculiar neighborhood of unaccountably neat and sturdy wooden homes, laid out in a grid, on a slope near the harbor. Those houses were shipped over here from Canton, in pieces but ready to be assembled. They're very popular, and their owner is about to make a fortune. Can't say as much for the rest of the Chinese. Where's Xioli? I asked, this being the name of the witch we were to recruit. Since you did all the research, I assume you have some idea? I guess the Chinese have brothels as well. Grognier cut me a look. Why are you even suggesting that? Do you think all witches are prostitutes? Well, in all fairness, you...
Sure wasn't I a spy for the O'Malley, she said with ferocity. Prostitution was a front, and didn't I only engage in it to suit my own purposes?
Anyhow, she said, collecting herself, and making a let's-put-this-behind-us gesture.
It certainly isn't the case here. There be no witches amongst the Chinese tarts. No witch would be finding herself in the straits those poor women are subjected to. No. Our Lady is right across the square there, in the fancy hotel, the St. Francis. Not much saintly about it from what I hear.
She chuckled her distinctively Grognier chuckle, took me by the hand, and led me across the dry dirt square. We entered the lobby of the St. Francis. Like the Golden Mounds, there was tacky, tawdry opulence everywhere, much as I imagine Vegas must look, but without the neon. And a woman unlike any Chinese witch I had expected was standing by a card table in the center of the room. Xioli was tall and elegant, almost gentlemanly, feet unbound, although I noticed when she walked that she walked stiffly. Her dress was an ingenuous blend of Oriental and Western that revealed just enough flesh to make a gentleman inclined to stare, and yet concealed enough that she could, technically, pass as modest, at least here. She was watching the card game, and at a certain point she settled upon the arm of one player's chair. She moved with the demure grace of a geisha pouring tea, and yet, at the same moment, somehow with brazen confidence as well. She was beautiful and spellbinding. Literally spellbinding. She was helping her companion cheat at cards. For a few moments, we watched the card game. Xioli's companion was also Chinese,
a gentleman with short hair, cut in the Western style. There were three other players, all white men, one young, two chubby and older. Standing back from the table were an assortment of servantish types, including a Chinese man with long hair and a queue. "'Tis a weak magic here," said Grania under her breath at last. "She's using soft magic to influence their choices, rather than what I'd do in her place, change the order of the cards in the deck." I recalled Ersabet lamenting on the cheap parlor tricks she'd been forced to perform to earn her keep, back in, well, just about now, actually. What an odd thought. That at this very moment, Ersabet was a young witch, somewhere in Eastern Europe, innocent to all that lay ahead. We watched the game to its completion. That is to say, to her partner's satisfaction. And then without hesitation, Xiu Li turned with radiant grace and walked elegantly directly toward us. She greeted Grania as if a friend she knew attended her. Not surprising, as I have come to understand that witches recognize each other in subtle ways.
"You are no witch," the tall, elegant woman said to me.
"Along for the ride with me, she is. Grania, I am by name, and this is Melisande, and you are Xiu Li."
Xiu Li smiled, her teeth small, opalescent pearls.
"Yes."
"We've a proposition for you," said Grania. "Be there a place to talk in private?"
"There is a room upstairs," said Xiu Li. "I do most of my business there."
I confessed deep curiosity to know what her business was, but as Grania was clearly the lead doer here, I satisfied myself with following along quietly. We headed for a wooden staircase. It seemed to me that somebody was following us up the stairs, and sure enough, at the top, we were stopped by a Caucasian gentleman who had been just behind us.
"Hey, Shirley,"
he said, mispronouncing her name in a nasal voice.
"Introduce me to your friends here."
He had a flat accent, akin to what I would in my own time describe as Midwestern.
"We talk first, and then we talk to you," said Xiu Li, with cold friendliness.
"Hi, I'm Francis Overstreet," he said,
offering his hand to Grania, and then to me.
"St. Francis, is it?" Grania smiled.
"Hardly,"
he said in much the same tone.
"Although I am the proprietor of this fine establishment, and as Miss Shirley here knows, when courtesan services are being established, I not only get a cut, but I get to sample the wares."
He turned a leering eye to the two of us, and, determining at once which was more leer-worthy, he winked at Grania. I confess a certain relief. If he were not handsome, his demeanor would be utterly repugnant. But he was a man in the prime of life, fine-looking, his face intelligent. A portrait of him would suggest a man of integrity and dignity. So the leer was more disorienting than disgusting. Grania was already giving him an inviting smile.
"After supper?" she suggested. "I've some errand to run before that." "My dance card is otherwise empty."
He smiled back. "Oh, good," I said, nudging Grania slightly, as I realized that expression would mean nothing to her.
"Oh, good,"
she echoed.
"Invite a friend,"
she added, pushing me slightly toward him. He looked nonplussed, further confirmation I was the less delectable morsel. Francis Overstreet trotted back down the stairs to oversee his glamorous den of iniquity, as Xiu Li led us a short way down the corridor to a small room, made all round of sanded wooden planks, with admirably clean windows, that looked out over the square.
"Your business?" she asked coolly.
"Magic's dying off," said Grania matter-of-factly. "I'm sure you felt it."
After a sober, studied pause, Xiu Li nodded once.
"I have. I wondered if it was to do with being in this new world that has no history or civilization."
"It has plenty of history," I corrected her. "The native people have had witches and magic all along. But they are feeling the loss as well. Everyone is."
"In fact," continued Grania, "we are about to lose magic entirely."
Xiu Li's eyes opened wide, She did not speak. But that is temporary, I amended. Many years from now, in the future, magic is restored and used in a very different way in society. We are here to encourage you to come forward with us to a time when magic will be strong again. There are some caveats, but it will be far better than being stuck here in this time and place, especially as a Chinese woman. She was ignoring me, her intense black eyes studying Grania's face. Why does it end? What stops it?
Photography, said Grania confidingly.
Xiao Li received this and mused upon it for a moment.
I see, she said at last.
As if she really did see, although she obviously lacked the education to grasp it in the manner that we at Dodo did.
How long do we have before it is gone?
July, next year, said Grania sympathetically. There's a solar eclipse, witnessed by everyone in Europe, and someone takes a photograph of it, and that's that.
She snapped her fingers.
It's over. So you'd best consider our offer and come forward with us.
I stared at Grania. She was strikingly well-informed for an Anachron. Who would have told her something that specific? It must have been Ersebet. Xiao Li's pale skin had paled even further hearing this. She sank onto a stool, her heavy silk dress shifting gracefully around her legs so that she appeared almost a mermaid.
This is dreadful news.
Yes, said Grania,
with no sense of dread at all.
You take some time to think it over. Melisande, let's be seen in the city, and we'll return by tea time.
She took me by the hand in her casually familiar way, and led me out of the room, down the hall, down the stairs, and back out into the square. Where are we going? I asked.
Sure, I'd love to see the city, said Grania. But in truth, there's a gentleman here to introduce ourselves to.
What gentleman? I demanded. I don't recall that being part of the deed.
Not that deed is written, agreed Grania. But there is more going on than meets the eye here. Blevin set me on to him and explained he could not put it down into the official assignment because it is... What was that phrase he was using now? Deep cover? Black cops?
Black ops, I said, rolling my eyes. Black operations. Covert activity.
Covert? Oi, there you go, said Grania,
without a shred of the sober demeanor one associates with such discussions.
What reason he wanted us to come here together was so that you could be witness to it all, but off the record, like. In fact, this whole deed is a different beast than you are currently thinking.
I felt a wave of alarm, but pushed it aside.
This was irregular, but not dangerous. Will you explain yourself? I said. Surely, said Grania. There's a fugger here, a direct male descendant of the one I know in my generation. He knows to expect us, and he'll help with the deed.
The more she revealed, the more confounding it seemed.
How? I demanded. How on earth can he possibly know to expect us? Nobody's ever been close to this detap before.
Melisande, she said, in a confiding, delighted voice. What is the one thing you can carry through time with you?
Information, I said.
Indeed, she said. And it's a wide variety of ways, so it is, that information can be carried through time. If it's gone back in time, the information's got to move magically. But if it's coming forward, it can be planted and moved through generations.
Do you mean you told this fellow's ancestor to meet you in San Francisco in 1850?
And they've passed the information along, accurately and without embellishment, for 2.5 centuries?
I was incredulous. This was an extremely dangerous way to work with historical agents.
It's not nearly that specific, said Grania blithely. Think of it more as a mythology. The Fuggers know, all of them, that there's an immortal red-haired Irish witch named Grania, who is an ally of the family in any generation. And the family knows this and keeps it close to themselves. And 'tis true enough that this witch
in 1602, did recommend to the family patriarch of the time to keep an eye westward, ever westward, over the generations. It has served them well, and this is as westward as it gets. So, I was not surprised when I did my internet research to be confirmed in my belief that there would be a fugger already here, opening a bank, and prepared to make ungodly profits. And he is already an ally, though he has never met me, nor has his sire, grandsire, great-grandsire going back many generations. But they know about me. It's delighted he'll be by our presence, and he'll help us, no questions asked. 'Tis a remarkable boon for our needs. What will he do? I asked, struggling to keep up with all this. Did Tristan know any of this? Surely Frank Oda or Mortimer must, as they oversaw the chronotron data, and none of this could be managed without tremendous chronotron oversight. Why had I not been told? Here's the second part you do not know, she said. We are not actually meant to bring her forward in time. What? I cried. Then what are we doing here? We're here to recruit her, said Grania. Much as I recruited the fuggers. If she comes forward in time, what do we have? One more witch. But if we leave her here, educated and motivated to pass the family legend down, then we can sculpt her to our needs. And seven generations hence, its allies will have in all her dutiful descendants. And if we set her up so that her descendants will be people of power in America, then, when we come to them in the 21st century, it's powerful allies we will have. They will have things that we need, because we will arrange now for them to have such things. Again, I was utterly gobsmacked. What a very clever and extremely dangerous methodology. And shocking that I had not been told of it. Again, I wondered, had Tristan? Was he also in the dark? Or had he begun to keep secrets from me? Three banks had already opened in or near Portsmouth Square, and the third bank was owned by the current Mr. Fugger. Grania wrote a note to have delivered to him. And after we waited for a few minutes in the brick lobby, brick, in that time and place, proof these were no ordinary bankers, the gentleman appeared, in very fine and sober attire, and received Grania as if she were Santa Claus and he a toddler. They exchanged certain code phrases that she had planted with his ancestor to reassure each other, or to reassure him. Grania had this insouciantly in hand. He was only too happy to follow us back to the St. Francis, where his duty would be to set up Chiu Li as the wealthiest Chinese immigrant in all of California. I do not know, I suppose I shall never know now, if Grania offered him other incentives to fork over a chunk of his private fortune to a total stranger, and a Chinese woman, no less. But determined, even eager, was he to fork it over. Now, said Grania, as we all stepped lightly across the square. It's hopeful I am of this matter being wrapped up quick enough. But 'tis a matter of logistics that we will have a gentleman caller who must be dispatched politely. This may require you to pretend to be Melisande's companion for an hour. Young Fugger regarded me with skepticism, but was too polite to express his disappointment. His eyes, however, strayed not infrequently to Grania's curvier shape, as we walked back toward the St. Francis. Back in the upstairs room, we found a grim Chiu Li.
I am not yet resolved to go, she said, almost pouting.
If pouting can be applied to a woman of such mature and majestic bearing. There is another way, said Grania. This immediately commanded Chiu Li's attention. Yes, there's always the option to stay here. And swap out magic for dosh, if you have that phrase here. Money. This gentleman is an associate of ours, and he will happily set you up for life, and for your children's lives, and your children's children's lives.
Xiao Li's bright eyes narrowed, and she looked back and forth between them. I might as well have not been present.
There is always a condition to these matters, she said. What is the condition here? Must I marry this Caucasian? I am already the mistress of the celestial Zhongli.
Granya shook her head.
No condition, but that you think well of us, myself and the gentleman here. And breed, if you haven't yet, but choose the man yourself, sure. Then raise your children to think well of our memory, and to raise their children to do likewise, and their children, and so on down the line. One day in the future, I might be meeting one of your descendants, and I would have them very well disposed toward me.
With a wink to me, as if I were a part of all of this unsettling collusion, she commented,
Worked a wonder with the fuggers. Might as well try it again, isn't it?
Xiao Li thought this over.
When magic disappears, she said, are witches gone? Do the powers lie dormant through the generations? Or are they entirely snuffed out?
Oh, the magic comes back just fine, so it does, said Grania. Although, it takes the witches a while to get the feel for it.
So, a distant daughter of mine
is what I'm saying, said Grania, nodding.
Xiao Li pursed her lips and looked out the window. It seemed to me an eternity passed, and I was not comfortable about this, as time was drawing near for Francis Overstreet to return to test the wares, and I did not like the idea of pretending to be a prostitute with Mr. Fugger as my client. Xiao Li finally turned to us.
I will agree to this, but I want a contract and surety.
Mr. Fugger raised his handsome leather briefcase.
I've got it all arranged here, he said. But this is hardly a place to do respectable business, so I'd like to bring you both to supper, where my cook will treat you like royalty.
Both, I echoed, now feeling even more invisible in a manner that was beginning to make my hackles rise. There are three of us here. The gentleman turned to me.
Miss Grania said you'd be wanting to return home as soon as possible.
Yes, but...
There's no need of you to stay here, said Grania cheerfully. This was really my deed all along. We only needed you to come along to cover my tracks. If I return a few scant hours after you, 'tis no concern of anyone there.
With a wink.
And the longer you stay here, the likelier you are to be called to service. Not that anyone would be too hot to hoist that skirt up off your bony hips.
I reviewed my options. Grania had entirely commandeered the situation, mostly because I was so unprepared for any of these developments. But it seemed clear enough that Blevins had entrusted her as a doer. I could not see a benefit to my remaining here any longer. And frankly, it would be helpful to have some time in Cambridge without Grania underfoot, to suss out how all of this had come to pass. Thank you, yes, I'll go home now, I said.
Excellent, said Grania, and turned to Xiao Li. Do you have much experience sending people?
Xiao Li shrugged. As children, my sisters and I did it as a game. But as magic weakened, it became very difficult, the fun not worth the effort.
I'll be refreshing your memory then, said Grania. I shall home mail. And you, watching me, will then know how to home me, after our agreeable dinner.
Xiao Li nodded.
But I need you to be paying particular attention, said Grania, as a few things will be different. In particular, the coordinates of where we are to end up.
How so? I asked. We are both returning to the same place.
No, said Grania,
in an amused yet apologetic smile.
We're not, actually, Melisande Stokes.
Suddenly I had a terrible feeling in the pit of my stomach. A premonition, which is not, dear reader, something I am prone to. I sensed it had something to do with Grania's detailed knowledge about photography and the significance of the eclipse. Where are you going? I asked.
Oh, it's back to Dodo headquarters for myself, sure, she said. Oh, I've stacks to do there, and I can't have you underfoot.
So it's elsewhere I am sending you, where there will be no magic strong enough to send you forward.